Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Gilad Sharon, son of former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, and author of the new book, Sharon, The Life of a Leader. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's hard to believe it's December already. The years seem to flow quicker and quicker, don't they? And having spent an afternoon doing Hanukkah shopping last week, I'm already really, really sick of Christmas carols. It doesn't take long, apparently, to tire of Bing Crosby and Gene Autry in the year 2011, for Pete's sake. Rudolph and the Little Drummer Boy and Sleigh Bells in the Snow. Or is it Snow Bells in the Sleigh? Anyway, they have more or less passed beyond the realm of trite to the land of kitsch. And we have three more weeks of this stuff to go. Now, I'm sure that many of you love carols, many of which were actually written by Jews, and the whole elaborate commercial enterprise of the American holiday season warms your heart. I even know many Jews who enjoy it to some degree, including plenty who aren't even in retail. But I must admit that after just a couple of hours in a mall, I was waxing nostalgic for the year I lived in Jerusalem. It was around December 20th or so that year I realized something was very different about that December. It took a few minutes before it occurred to me that the major change was that I hadn't heard a single Christmas carol, or indeed one reference to Christmas the entire month. There'd been no Black Fridays or Cyber Mondays, no tinsel or colored lights or statues of Santa Claus, no huge crowds stampeding into stores or clogging the shops, no dogs barking jingle bells, no chestnuts roasting on an open fire, no elves, no shtick at all. And that, mind you, was in the country of origin for the whole Christian religion. You know, it was a Machiah. Now, as you faithful listeners of Two Jewish know, I enjoy holidays as much as anyone, and with Hanukkah coming up soon, we'll have plenty of pre-festival music and comedy and information to share. But it's also the case that as a Jew, it really is kind of nice to be in a place, that is Israel, where someone else's holiday doesn't overwhelm everything for more than a month before it actually happens. Well, we've got a festival coming up in about 2.5 weeks that has a great deal to recommend it anyway. For one thing, it commemorates an actual historical event. For another, it celebrates a real victory over religious intolerance and oppression. And so to play us in this morning, here's a pre-Chanukah song from the Sephardic tradition, Mizeh Yimalel, who can retell the great things our God did for us in those days at this time of year. Was a little more of our pre-Chanukah musical preview, this time from the Western Winds, Mizeh Yimalel. Now, I must remind you that there are only 17 more shopping days until Chanukah begins, folks. Of course, you can always buy Chanukah presents during Chanukah. You've got 8 days and the post-sales and... Oh, never mind. On a more serious note, our guest this morning had the closest of views of power and politics in Israel. He's the highly articulate son of Israeli lightning rod and former Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, one of the most important and controversial figures in the history of Israel. Find out what Sharon was like and what he really thought of Bibi Netanyahu when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. The other day when I was struggling to come up with an idea for a new Mama's commercial, I overheard a family talking about their son's high school football team. My mind raced back to 1964 in Long Island, New York, when my brother Vinny played football for the West Hempstead High School Rams. Vinny was a great player, and of course the whole Spina family went to each and every game. After the games, we'd often come home and Mom would make one of her delicious Sicilian-style pizzas. My mouth still waters when I think of the great rich-tasting tomato sauce and creamy fresh mozzarella cheese sitting on top of her warm, homemade semolina dough. It's the exact great taste we put into the pizzas we make every day at our mama's restaurants in Tucson. You know, I love thinking about football and the good old days in New York. I just wish all this reminiscing would help me come up with a good idea for a new radio commercial. Repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Ready to move your child to an outstanding private school? Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA, is accepting a limited number of enrollments for January 2012, mid-year. THA's kindergarten through 8th grade integrated curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, thereby providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes even, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. THA graduates capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter high school, ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. A great education is more affordable than you think, and the best education comes from THA. Space is limited. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning, Gilad Sharon. He's the youngest of Ariel Sharon's sons. He has a master's degree in economics, writes a column for Yediot Ahronot, perhaps the best-read Israeli newspaper. Major in the IDF reserves, he currently manages his family's farm, which just doesn't quite give it full credence in Israel. His new book is called Sharon, The Life of a Leader, by his son Gilad Sharon. Boker Tov, good morning.
Shalom, good morning, Rabbi.
So tell me why you decided to write this biography of your dad now.
I was exposed during the years to so many events described in the book, and I heard stories from my father about events that took place before I was born. And I had the privilege and the honor to be my father's confidant, to enjoy his trust. And so I have a very intimate point of view, and I bring the less known sides of my father, the personal parts of my father's life, for instance, endless tours on the farm while I'm driving and he's sitting beside me. We would go between the sheep and the cattle. And my father, who loves very much animals, had very hard time parting from the animals, even when they were not productive anymore. So I would say, Dad, if it would be up to you, we'd open an old age home for sheep and cows that neither give birth nor milk. He would say, oh, just give her another chance.
You know, your father's, you talk about your dad's openness with you, your father's loyalty is kind of legendary. If he trusted somebody, he really trusted them and stayed friends with them. And the other side, of course, also true. If he didn't trust someone, he really didn't. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, lucky for me, I was, I was someone that he did trust. But my father always, he gave the responsibility. I remember I was still on my vacation, the relief vacation from the army when I was leaving, and I took upon myself the whole running of our farm. And my father trusted me always. I was his close confidant. He took me even to a trip, a secret trip to Zaire. I remember one day, it's not a secret anymore. But the previous, when he went there with my mother before that, he went to Africa. It was 1981, and he was appointed Minister of Defense. And the idea was to reestablish the Israelis' relationships with African countries. The country that left the strongest impression was Zaire, with the President Mobutu Sese Seko, who immediately fell in love with my father. And so, as an act of honor and love, he invited my parents to his home village, and there, the greatest honor of all, he invited them to go fishing with him. Now, Mobutu Sese Seko was not aware of my father's sense of humor, and so each time they were sitting under those sun umbrellas, hot African sun above, the jungle around, they were sitting around a small pond, fishing rods in their hands, and each time the president would caught a fish, my father would announce, "The president had caught a fish." And then again, the president had caught another fish. But then we were very close to a diplomatic incident because my mother, who never went fishing before or after, managed to catch more fish than the president. And so the whole reestablish of the relationship was in danger. We had a situation there. But the
she had to stop catching fish at some point.
No. There was another solution was found. The president's servants were removing fish from my mother's basket to the president's basket. and so it's a true story. And so the relationship was saved.
There's an incredible pictures in your book, your father inspecting troops in Zaire, and then a picture of him fishing with Mobutu Sese Seko, the president of Zaire.
Yeah, and me as Tarzan in Zaire.
Yes. We will talk much more with Gilad Sharon, the son of Ariel Sharon, about his new book, Sharon, The Life of a Leader, when we come back in just a few moments on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two-bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with Rabbi Sam Kohan is all set for May 30th to June 10th of 2012. If you're interested in going with me on this fantastic journey to Israel, email twojewishradio@yahoo.com, TOOJewishRadio@yahoo, or call 327-4501, area code 520-327-4501, for more information and an itinerary. This week we read the great Torah portion of Vayishlach. It includes the remarkable story of Jacob wrestling with an angel and being renamed Israel. Poet Yehuda Amichai, an Israeli, wrote a weird, wonderful parable about a man and a woman called Jacob and the angel. It's our Jewish Poetry Slam of the week. Just before dawn, she sighed and held him that way and defeated him. And he held her that way and defeated her. And both of them knew that a hold brings death. They agreed to do without names. But in the first light, he saw her body, which remained white in the places the swimsuit had covered yesterday. And then someone called her suddenly from above, twice, the way you call a little girl from playing in the yard. And he knew her name and let her go. That was the Jewish Poetry Slam for this morning, Jacob and the Angel by Yehuda Amichai. We continue now with our pre-Hanukkah musical preview with Kenny Ellis' swinging take on a Ladino folk song, Ocho Candelicas, Eight Candles for Hanukkah.
Hanukkah linda está aquí, ocho candelas para mí. Hanukkah linda está aquí, ocho candelas para mí. Oh, una candelica, dos candelicas, tres candelicas, cuatro candelicas, cinco candelicas, seis candelicas, siete candelicas. Ocho candelas para mí. Muchas fiestas voy a hacer con alegrías y placer. Muchas fiestas voy a hacer con alegrías y placer. Oh, una candelica, dos candelicas, tres candelicas, cuatro candelicas, cinco candelicas, seis candelicas, siete candelicas. Ocho candelas para mí. Candelas para mí, ocho candelas para mí, ocho candelas para mí.
That was Ocho Candelicas, Eight Candles for Hanukkah by singer Kenny Ellis. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
All right, so look, everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. When we think about Israel, most people think about a hot, sunny, dry country. But I have lived in Jerusalem in the month of December, and it rained every bloody day, and it was freezing cold. Talk a little bit about, you're from Haifa. Talk about the weather in Israel. You know, there's a winter there, actually.
Yes, you know, it's funny because people here in Tucson, which is a desert, assume that Israel is a desert. Now, it's true that 70% of the land in Israel is desert, but that's the southern part, all the way up to Be'er Sheva. When you cross Be'er Sheva and start going up north, you're getting to an area that is quite rainy on the winter and actually have some snow. You know, Jerusalem is great when it's snowing. It's amazing. And kids are waiting for the snow because then all the schools close. And
nobody can drive and they don't have any snow removal equipment. And if they get any accumulation, the whole city stops and it's a holiday. Yeah.
Well, they have some equipment, but usually they start fixing the equipment only after the first
right when
snow.
It's snowing. Right?
You know, they remember that, oh yeah, we need to check the, you know, yeah, all that. Haifa, where I was born, has rain. And for my personal experience, when I was a teenager, my favorite thing to do when it was raining was to find some friends and to go hiking in the Carmel Mountain. Because what most people don't know about the Carmel Mountain is that the streams don't have water flow all year long. But when it's raining, they do. So, yeah, you pay the price of getting wet. But on the other hand, that's the only opportunity you really have to walk along those streams and see, you know, the flushing water, and that's great, and the smell of the earth after the rain. It's a unique smell. That's, for me, this is the smell of Israel, the smell of the land after rain, where I don't know exactly what makes this smell. It's something in the earth that kind of opens and breathes in the air after the rain. Another great experience for me as a child in Haifa, and that's probably only Haifa and Jerusalem people are quite familiar with, is to go and pick mushrooms. There is a special kind of mushrooms called orniot, which are pine trees mushrooms. They grow only where there are pine trees and only after rain. And for a very short period of time, and they taste like heaven. You know, you pick them up and you cook with them, you make a soup or stuff like that. And that's the feeling of winter, you know, when you come back home and there is the smell of a soup boiling on the stove with the mushroom flavor in the air. And that's the feeling of winter. In the last several years, I must admit, it was harder and harder to find those mushrooms. I don't know why, but that's my feeling of winter in Israel as a child.
It's a great memory. See, beautiful season, winter in Israel. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant, J-Bar, and Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
J-Bar is a great place to go for the holidays. What's special about it?
I think the things that's special about it, it's so casual. The food speaks of where we live, great views of the city, phenomenal margaritas, inexpensive, casual, spontaneous, friends in from out of town, you don't feel like cooking, kids are in, come on over to J-Bar.
My wife's favorite are the fish tacos, which are not like the fish tacos get everywhere else. They're just spectacular.
No, we like to do things a little bit differently, and I think a little bit better, and just really celebrate the flavors of where we live.
A great fun place for a holiday meal or any time. What's the best way to get a hold of J-Bar?
Give us a call, 615-6100. Go online, visit our website, www.janos.com.
That's JANOS.com. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Greece has been in the news a great deal because of the European debt crisis and its incredibly important impact on the whole world financial system. Talk a little bit about that, but also let's talk about the Greek Jewish community, which is ancient and interesting and a little complicated.
Well, I know a lot more about the Greek Jewish community than I do about the Greek economic system. But what's funny is these two guys who are the main rivals for power now in Greece, George Papandreou, who is the prime minister, and Tony Samaras, who's the prime minister in waiting, as it were, and who need to compromise to make things work, are both people I knew pretty well when I worked as a diplomat. They were much more junior then. Papandreou back then was the real Papandreou's son, and he grew up in Brooklyn, so his English is fluent. And even
well,
though
if
he
you
was
can call someone
be,
from Brooklyn fluent right. in English,
he was supposed to be this fiery left winger, but he seemed pretty moderate to me. A very nice, intelligent guy, and Tony Samaras was also a very nice, intelligent guy. But you know, politicians tend to seek differences more often than they tend to seek common ground. They tend to define themselves against the other. So this goes back to what we were talking about the past couple of weeks on tolerance in a certain way. So basically, Greece, with a lot of misgivings, was admitted to the Eurozone from the very beginning, and its economy probably wasn't strong enough or rigorously enough controlled to merit inclusion in the Eurozone. They had to widen some margins and make things more flexible to include Greece. But in the early days, they wanted to make the Eurozone as big as possible. Turns out that might have been a mistake, and the continued health of the euro, and therefore of Europe's economy, and therefore of the world's economy, which is altogether rather shaky now, seems to rest on the willingness of Northern Europeans to bail out their more fun-loving Greek cousins who like to sit around in cafes all day and drink. I mean, it's, you know, there are cultural differences. And yeah,
sounds kind of nice, but probably not too productive.
Right. But, you know, a lot of Greeks would like to have a job, but their economy is shaky and they can't work. And there is a certain lifestyle question of Mediterranean versus Nordic. This is a kind of a timeless thing. And that's why some of the other questionable countries in the Eurozone are the southern countries. I mean, Italy, Spain, Portugal. And there is a lot of worry in economic circles that it's all a house of cards, and that if one piece falls, the whole thing will fall. And that's sort of what happened with our subprime mortgage crisis. And, you know, one company collapsed and the whole system collapsed. And the American economy, what, 5-7 years later, is sort of still recovering. So we're not that different from the Europeans. If you want to talk about Greek Jews and the Greek Jewish community, a subject about which I know much more, we should probably do that next time.
All right. Well, we will, Tom. And as we get into the Greek Jews, we'll gradually work our way closer to Hanukkah, which is a Greek Jewish conflict holiday anyway.
So absolutely.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
Look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sadie and Maurice Goldberg are celebrating their 25th wedding anniversary with a group of friends. But Maurice looks so unhappy, his best friend Moshe, a criminal lawyer, goes over to him. "What's the matter, Maurice?" he says. "Why do you look so sad?" "Why, do you remember my 5th anniversary when I asked you what would happen if I murdered Sadie?" "Yes," answers Moshe. "I said you'd get 20 years in jail." "Well," says Maurice, "I would have been a free man tonight." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and stay free. Family dynamics play a central role in the whole book of Genesis, from Adam and Eve and their loving sons, Cain and Abel, through the intricacies of Joseph's awful relationships with his brothers. In fact, you can easily claim that the Torah teaches us all about family life by showing us how not to live it. But the most complicated of all the families in Genesis, and we began the book with the first older brother in history murdering his younger sibling, of course. Oh, and then it continues with a series of terrible intra-family rivalries. Well, the most complex and intricate of all the dysfunctional family groups we encounter in the Torah is surely that of our great ancestor Jacob, his 4 wives and 13 children. In this week's portion of Vayishlach, Jacob is returning to his homeland of Canaan, someday to be known as Israel, when he hears rumors of the approach of his fearsome and feared brother Esau, headed his way, accompanied by 400 armed men. Jacob is in a panic. Seeking to save at least half his family from utter destruction, he divides his household in half. And in the darkness of the night, before his coming encounter with Esau's mini army, Jacob crosses alone to a small island in the middle of a tributary of the Jordan River. There, he encounters a representative of God. Perhaps a man, perhaps an angel, perhaps a spirit from a dream, perhaps his own conscience, we don't know. The text is very ambiguous about the nature of the second combatant, but one thing is clear. The enemy wrestles with Jacob all night, and when neither can prevail, the two reach a truce as dawn breaks. The conclusion of this encounter includes an important change for Jacob. He's given a new name, Yisrael, Israel, one who wrestles with God. Jacob, now also called Israel, goes on to meet Esau, and surprisingly, the brothers resolve their lifelong differences. It's an important act of forgiveness and reconciliation, a kind of modeling that will matter for Jacob's own children when Joseph and his brothers ultimately reunite a generation later, after similarly disastrous sibling rivalries. Unfortunately, the rest of Jacob's family life remains problematic. filled with conflict and complexity, sorrows and heartbreak. But at least one example is created of a way to emerge from the heartache of family struggle. If first we learn to encounter God, to wrestle with the divine, we may be able to find our way back to those we love. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest Gilad Sharon will share some of the most interesting and surprising incidents from the life of his father, Ariel Sharon. Find out what he really thought about peace with the Palestinians and many other subjects when we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K-12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple, $500 per individual as a tax credit, and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israeli economic sanctions against the Palestinians in retaliation for their bid to win world recognition of a state of Palestine have started to bite. Palestinian Authority officials in the West Bank said last week they won't be able to pay the next round of public sector salaries, which support nearly one-third of Palestinians, and that the damage to their fragile economy could be devastating. Israel is currently impounding funds it collects on behalf of the Palestinians, about $100 million a month of customs charges and other taxes. That forms nearly two-thirds of the local revenue of the West Bank-based government of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Israel says freezing the money is intended as a warning to Abbas. The measure could turn permanent if he decides to form a unity government with his long-standing rivals, the Islamic terrorist Hamas, which has ruled the Gaza Strip since its violent takeover from Abbas and Fatah in 2007. Such a unity government was to have been formed ahead of Palestinian elections next May, and there have been talks in the last couple of weeks between Abbas and Hamas, but so far, no decisions. Israel started suspending the release of funds last month in response to the Palestinian success in gaining admission to the UN's cultural agency UNESCO, part of a larger effort to try to gain recognition as a state in the world body. Israel says a Palestinian state should be established through negotiations and accuses the Palestinians of acting unilaterally to bypass any potential peace talks. The suspension comes at a time of growing cash crisis in Abbas's Palestinian Authority. you know, follow the money. Foreign donors are now several hundred million dollars short of the nearly $1 billion in support the Palestinians sought this year. They had a proposed budget of $3.2 billion for 2011, including $1.7 billion needed to cover the government payroll. Abbas's prime minister, Salam Fayyad, says he won't be able to pay upcoming salaries due this week. The Palestinian Authority pays the wages of about 150,000 civil servants and members of the security forces. That includes tens of thousands of beneficiaries in Gaza who were pushed out of their jobs after the Hamas takeover, but still get their salaries from Fatah. The Israeli government officials said the suspension was intended to deter Abbas from bypassing peace talks. Bibi Netanyahu has offered to resume negotiations, but Abbas insists Israel must first halt all construction in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, areas the Palestinians continue to claim for their potential state. In the rumor mill, former International Monetary Fund chairman Dominique Strauss-Kahn is being discussed as a replacement for incumbent Bank of Israel governor Stanley Fischer when he leaves in about 3.5 years. French dailies reported that Strauss-Kahn may be nominated as the next governor of the Bank of Israel once Fischer steps down. Strauss-Kahn made headlines in the past year after being forced to resign from the International Monetary Fund following his arrest on charges of sexual assault and attempted rape of a New York hotel maid. They were dismissed by a New York court in August following doubts concerning the maid's credibility. According to the French papers, Strauss-Kahn and his wife, journalist Anne Sinclair, who visited Israel last week, may emigrate to Israel for an indefinite period of time. The French couple's visit to Kahn's Jewish-French friend Jean Friedman led to a slew of rumors regarding his future position, wrote one paper. In Jerusalem, Israeli archaeologists last week said they had found ancient coins that overturned widely held beliefs about the origins of Jerusalem's Western Wall, Judaism's holiest site. For centuries, many thought the wall was completed by King Herod, but archaeologists said they have found coins buried under the wall's foundation, minted 20 years after Herod's death in 4 BCE, showing that the structure had to have been completed by his successors. The find will mean a little bit of a rethink for the army of tour guides who show people that part of the city. Every tour guide grounded in the history of Jerusalem replies Herod when asked who built the wall, said the Israeli Antiquities Authority. This bit of archaeological information shows the fact the construction of the Temple Mount walls and Robinson's Arch was an enormous project that lasted decades and wasn't completed during Herod's lifetime. Academic historians are already aware of an account by the Jewish historian Josephus that the wall was completed by Herod's great-grandson, but, you know, tour guides say what tour guides say. Last week, Ryan Braun became the fourth Jew to be named a Most Valuable Player in Baseball, the first Jewish MVP since Sandy Koufax in 1963. The Milwaukee Brewers left fielder beat out Matt Kemp of the Dodgers after leading Milwaukee to the playoffs. Ryan Braun, who grew up in L.A., my hometown, hit .332 with 33 homers, 111 RBIs, and 33 steals. As he says, "I'm extremely proud to be a role model for young Jewish kids." The previous Jewish winners of the MVP include Hank Greenberg, Al Rosen, and Sandy Koufax. You know, it doesn't happen often, but it couldn't happen to a nicer or more deserving guy than Ryan Braun. Mazel tov. And in other sports news, with the basketball lockout over and the NBA and professional basketball starting again this month, Jordan Farmar, the first Jewish NBA player to play in the top Israeli league since Danny Shays 12 years ago, bid a fond farewell to his team, the top Israeli squad Maccabi Tel Aviv, and returned towards the New Jersey Nets. Farmar's mom is Jewish, his stepfather an Israeli. Among Farmar's teammates at Maccabi Tel Aviv was former Duke All-America John Shire. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Gilad Sharon. He's the author of the new book, Sharon, The Life of a Leader. He is the youngest of Ariel Sharon's sons, has a master's degree in economics, writes a column for Yediot Achronot, the best-read Israeli newspaper. He's a major in the IDF reserves and manages his family farm in the south of Israel. You know, there's a lot of, there are some aspects of this story. I've read a couple of long biographies of Ariel Sharon, and yet there's stuff here that perhaps only you had access to. Some maybe not as secret, but Sharon's role, your dad's role in setting up the initial meeting between Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin that led to the peace treaty, this very interesting little story there. Can you talk about that a little bit?
My father had a very close relationship with Arab leaders. When Sadat landed in Israel on November 1977, the first question he asked while he was still on his plane was, "Is General Sharon here?" Maybe he was afraid a little bit. And when he approached my father, shook my father's hand, and he said, "I was trying to catch you in the desert near the Suez Canal, in the Yom Kippur War, of course." And my father replied, "You have a chance to catch me as a friend right now." And indeed, they had very close relationships. I remember that my father, as a minister of agriculture, went to visit Sadat on his palace in Cairo. And there, Sadat asked him if he would be willing to go and check areas for in the west desert, the western desert, the Egyptian desert, to grow wheat for to feed the Egyptians. My father, of course, agreed immediately, and the next day he sat in what I guess is known as the Egyptian Air Force One, between in Sadat's plane, between two pilots, and they were flying. There my father found out that those two pilots were jet pilots, Egyptian pilots, that were trying to eliminate him while he was crossing the Suez Canal a few years before. And so the whole peace thing got a new meaning. Here he was between two pilots directing them, go up, go down, turn here, turn there. And only a few years before, they were trying to kill him when he was beating the Egyptian army.
It's really quite a contrast. Your father had a reputation, how can I say this, for with his superior officers for not necessarily listening to their directives. How valid did you think that was?
I think that if he would ignore some of the stupid orders that he received during the Yom Kippur War, many lives would be saved. But he did fulfill his orders because he served for many years. Since the age of 17, he was serving in the IDF, before the IDF, in the Haganah, in the underground. And so that's true that my father was not always very popular in the army, and they were trying to drive him out. But the reason, I guess, was because he, his personality, he was always so dominant, and his achievement, his energy, his abilities put almost all the rest in the shade. But the important thing is that as prime minister, the love towards him crossed every political boundary in Israel, and the support that he received was unmatchable. And you know what, Rabbi, it was not only in Israel. When I was during my research for the book, I was invited to the Oval Office. President Bush invited me. It was July 2008. And he said, "I admired your dad." And on March 2010, when I met with Prime Minister Blair, he told me, "I had huge respect for your father, Ariel Sharon. He is a courageous man and a visionary leader." So eventually, I think this is what counts.
You know, when Sharon was prime minister, he did some of the most extraordinary things. You know, he had been sort of the father of the settler movement. Ariel, after all, is really in a way named after him, the city in the West Bank. He was kind of the hero of the Likud. He chose to withdraw from Gaza unilaterally and leave Likud and start his own party. Only he could have done that. Was that a very difficult decision for him? I mean, it was sort of leaving everything that he seemed to represent in Israel in some ways.
I don't think so, Rabbi, because in Israel there was a consensus that if we would have a peace agreement with the Palestinians, we would not be sitting in the Gaza Strip.
Of course.
The only question that was still open, should we wait for an agreement that might never arrive, or should we do unilaterally what is the best for us? And he did the necessary step. He took a decision that only a great leader could take. It was proven in the Knesset. Most of the Knesset supported. It was a big majority. During my research for my book, Sharon, The Life of a Leader, I checked the polls since 2004 when it was announced until more than 2.5 years after he was not in position anymore. And all the time there was a big majority for leaving Gaza. And it was proven even in the elections after the withdrawal from Gaza, when the Likud received only 12 seats, the lowest number ever. And my father's party, the new party, formed a government with more than double the seats in the Likud. They got 28, and my father was ill then at that time. If my father would run that on those elections, all the indications shows he would get between 40 to 50 seats. And so it proves that the Israelis didn't want to sit in the Gaza Strip, pay the deadly price. But that would gave us the strength to hold with the necessary places in the West Bank. We would never receive the Bush letter to Sharon from April 14th, 2004, saying that Israel will not go back to the 67 borders, acknowledging that the blocks, the settlement blocks, will always remain in Israeli hands, and denying any Palestinian to enter Israel. All that is a result of withdrawal from Gaza. Now, there are people who think that withdrawing from Gaza brought the rocket, but that's not true, because we had rockets long before. The first rocket on Shderot, next to our farm where we live, all the family together, was fired at April 16, 2001. That's more than 4 years before the withdrawal. But I remember my father coming back from all those meetings with the heads of the army, with all kind of anti-terror suggestion, and legal advisor would say, you cannot do that, you're responsible for the territory. But once we went out from there, we can have our own anti-terror actions in the Gaza Strip. And that's exactly what we did on December 2008. We could never done that if we were still responsible for the area. And so he took a great decision that only a great leader could have taken and executed it. I see no one else that had the strength or the leadership to do so, not back then and not now.
So it's a hard question, and who knows, but had the stroke not occurred, do you think that your father would have managed the situation in a different way in dealing with Gaza and dealing with Hamas?
Let me put it that way. I'm sure he would do better.
There are a couple of controversial statements in the book, although I'm certain they're true. One, which sort of portrayed your father's, Ariel Sharon's, attitude towards Benjamin Netanyahu. There's some controversy now about Sarkozy, the president of France, talked about how Netanyahu was a liar, and President Obama sort of agreed. But Sharon didn't seem to have any ambiguity on that question. I quote him saying pretty clearly that Netanyahu was a liar. Have you taken much heat on that question?
Well, I describe the events as they were, and it is what it is.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, but it does sound like he had that opinion of the current Israeli prime minister.
You know what, Rabbi? Maybe he's changed by now.
It's a very good answer. I'm going to ask a difficult question. Your father's
spirit. What do you mean? All the rest were easy?
Oh, yes, of course. Okay, another difficult question. Your father spearheaded the war in Lebanon, and it was both militarily a tremendous success in the initial invasion of Lebanon all the way up to Beirut, and then became the worst controversy and really took him out of public life for a while when the Sabra Shatila massacres were perpetrated by the Christian phalanges. Tell us a little bit about how he responded to that.
Look, Rabbi, the massacre in the neighborhoods of Sabra and Shatila was a heavy crime, a grave tragedy. But we also must remember those were Christian Arabs who murdered Muslim Arabs, and everybody was blaming the Israelis for that.
Of course.
I remember on February 1983, Time magazine published an article suggesting that my father encouraged the Christians to murder the Palestinians. When my father saw that, he decided decided immediately to sue. And that was not an easy thing, to sue Time magazine in New York. I was with my parents on the first day of the trial and the coming days until I had to go to join the army. And eventually, both courts in the U.S. and in Israel ruled that those accusations were false or defamatory, and people in the magazine acted carelessly. In Lebanon, unfortunately, especially after the civil war started in 1975, Palestinians murdered Christians in Damour, early 76. Christian murdered thousands of Palestinians in Tel El-Zata. Christian were murdered in Aishia. There were murders in Karantina. Syrian killed Palestinians. Syrian killed Christian. Christian killed Christians. Shiite killed Christians. All those events were held before and after the events in Sabra and Shatila, but no one seemed to care. Only when there was some kind of indirect way to relate it to Israel, everybody seemed to care about what's going on in Lebanon.
You know, there's a statement I heard that says the only time the world seems to value an Arab life is when it's taken by a Jew. It's unfortunate.
And let me tell you, Rabbi, my father, as Minister of Defense in Menachem Begin's government, they would not allow a situation where the whole North was under the rocket fire of the PLO from Lebanon.
Right.
The life war in... people were living in shelters for months. People were starting to leave the north of Israel, the Galilee. And it took them 1 week to encircle Beirut. Now, I was a major in the reserves in 2006, while we had the second Lebanon War. And after a month of completely international freedom, and we arrived practically nowhere. And the rockets will keep falling on the north of Israel. So that can only show you what a great achievement that government had back then in 1982. But, you know, in my father's archive, which we maintain, I found so many documents, so many notes, so many letters from Prime Minister Ben-Gurion. I was shocked, and I don't know if I'm allowed to say that to a rabbi, but so many love letters that my father received during the years, even as prime minister. And I bring all that in my book, in Sharon, The Life of a Leader.
I want to thank Gilad Sharon for a terrific visit here on Two Jewish. His book is called Sharon, The Life of a Leader. It's just out from HarperCollins. You can get it everywhere. And I strongly recommend it. It's tremendous, detailed, and I think very candid look at Ariel Sharon and his career. So are you going to run for Knesset with Kadima?
I was so busy in the last 4.5 years with the book. I just want to spend some time with my family. I don't know what my plans are.
When we come back in just a moment, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 when our guest will be Neshama Karlbach, the singer and recording artist who will be here in Tucson at the Fox in a great program on December 17th. Don't miss it. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website, and please friend us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Hanukkah musical preview in the rock group The Bare Naked Ladies, whose lead singer, Stephen Page, was Jewish. It's their take on Hanukkah, oh Hanukkah. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Oh Hanukkah, come light the menorah. Let's have a party, we'll all dance the whore. Gather around the table, we'll give you a treat. A simply fun to play with and latkes to eat. And while we are playing, the candles are burning low. One for each night they shed a sweet light to remind us of days long ago. One for each night they shed a sweet light to remind us of days long ago. Burning low. One for each night they share.